might have prepared for this eventuality before you betrayed your master. Silence!
The lamps were back on, but the violin was growing louder by the second. The Countess paced the cabin, the book clutched to her chest. Seeing her scared made Kate even more afraid. How terrible must this dire Magnus be if the Countess, who had an army of undead soldiers at her command, who, upset as she was, still managed to keep Kate frozen and Dr. Pym pinned to the wall, trembled at the mere thought of him.
"It just seems to me," Dr. Pym said mildly, "that you might have put more thought into all this." "I said silence, you fool!"
The Countess was a cornered beast, dangerous and terrified.
"Well, I don't really see how I'm the fool. I didn't betray a being 10 times more powerful than myself and expect simply to get away with it."
The Countess whirled on him.
"It was you, wasn't it? You told him, sent him some sort of message."
A knife gleamed in the Countess's hand where none had been before. Kate strained to move, but it was no use. The music was growing ever louder, its pitch climbing as the tempo spun faster and faster. The Countess advanced on Dr. Pym.
"If I'm to die," she hissed, "it will not be alone."
Kate wanted to scream at Dr. Pym to do something, say some spell, spit on her if he had to. Then, quite abruptly, the music stopped. So did the Countess, knife poised above the wizard, her face a mask of rage and fear.
"My dear," Dr. Pym said, "I'm afraid your time has come."
And, like that, the Countess crumpled to the floor. Kate felt the grip on her relax. She almost collapsed herself, so great and immediate was the sense of liberation. Dr. Pym was free as well, but he signaled Kate to stay where she was. He was staring at the motionless body of the Countess. The Atlas lay beside her on the floor. What was he waiting for? This was their chance. They had to grab the book and run, escape, before... The body on the floor moved. Slowly, the Countess got to her feet. But something was different. Her blonde hair had turned a deep shade of green, and her eyes glittered as if set with diamonds. If anything, she was even more beautiful and magical than before. For one brief moment, the shining eyes rested on Kate. Then she turned to Dr. Pym and smiled.
"Stanislaus, it has been far too long."
And Kate understood. She was not looking at the Countess.
"So my sweet Countess was going to betray me and keep the Atlas for herself. My, my, when did loyalty become such a rare commodity?"
The creature stretched out the Countess's arms as if admiring how long and slender they were. It was a strange sight, watching someone appraise their own body.
"Perhaps the fault," Dr. Pym said, "lies not in the follower, but in the leader's inability to inspire."
The green-haired being laughed. It took Kate by surprise, for it was a real laugh, easy, mirthful, nothing like the bright, empty laughter of the Countess.
"Touché, Stanislaus. You are no doubt right. As always, my old friend. And this young woman, I wager, is unfailingly loyal to you."
Kate stiffened as he approached. Up close, Kate saw that the green of her hair was not the emerald of an open field, but the deep green-black of a jungle, the color seeming to move and shift as if alive, and there was a hunger in those glittering eyes that terrified Kate. Once again she heard the violin, faint at first. It was calling to her, inviting her to dance. It told her the day was ending, the world was on fire. It told her to dance while there was time to dance. It told her of burning cities, of people running in fear, of darkness, destruction, chaos, and ruin.
"Come," the music called. "Join the dance. Join the dance."
It reached deep, deep inside her, and, to her horror, Kate felt part of her respond. She wanted to spin away, to live, if only for a moment, before it all ended. No cares, no thoughts. And then she was staring at a skeleton with glittering eyes, and she yanked back as if she'd been teetering on the edge of a cliff. The music stopped. The Countess stood before her, green-haired, diamond-eyed. Not the Countess, but not a skeleton either.
"Stanislaus, it seemed your protégé doesn't wish to join my dance. It's only a matter of time, my dear. We all dance in the end."
Her chest heaving, Kate did her best to put on a fearless, defiant glare.
"Such bravery! That's good. You'll need every bit. You are one of them, aren't you? The children of the prophecy. I see it in your eyes."
The creature reached out and stroked Kate's hair. She could hear the eagerness in his voice and feel how his hand trembled with excitement.
"Do you know how long I've waited for this moment? I watched mountains climb out of oceans. I've seen empires rise and fall. Entire races have died forgotten. And through it all, I have waited. Your Dr. Pym talks of loyalty. I have been loyal, my dear. Such loyalty as has never been seen. For I always knew that one day we would find each other."
Kate stared into the ancient, glittering eyes and saw it all. She saw the centuries he'd waited. She saw how the world had changed about him, and yet he'd never lost purpose. How could she fight such resolve? This was her fate. There was no escape. From across the room, Dr. Pym said,
"You cannot stay here."
"Hmm?
Look at your hand."
The creature called the Diamagnus held up the Countess's hand. To Kate's shock, the knuckles were growing thick and knobby. Veins were beginning to push against the pearl-white skin. The Diamagnus seemed neither surprised nor particularly worried.
"Clever, Stanislaus. You invite me here to defeat my own servant, knowing full well I cannot linger. You've lost none of your wit, my friend. No matter."
He looked at Kate.
"I have seen what I needed to see."
He turned then and picked up the book. He was aging quickly now, middle age, old age, and it was a bent-backed crone who shuffled across the cabin and offered the atlas to Kate. The once beautiful face was lost in wrinkles. The green hair was dry and patchy. Smiling at Kate, he showed two rows of broken yellow teeth. His words were a hollow croak.
"The end is near, child. I will be coming for you. Our destinies are one. I will be coming. And when I find you, all the world will dance."
At these words, the creature departed. Kate felt his presence leave the room, and the Countess's body dropped to the floor and didn't move. Dr. Pym staggered.
"Dr. Pym, I'm fine, my dear. Simply the strain. He was pushing so hard. What happened to him? The Diamagnus cannot take form here. He must possess another, and the Countess was too frail a host. I will explain later. We must hurry. There is little time.
He collapsed. Kate ran to his side, and she was still shaking him and calling his name when she heard the explosion. Chapter 23. The Children of Cambridge Falls. Emma's ears were ringing. Her ankle throbbed, and she was drenched head to toe. All around her, huge jets of water streamed through cracks in the face of the dam. The sound was deafening. She looked, but didn't see the monster. Was it possible the explosion had killed it? The dam groaned. More boards cracked and splintered.
"Gabriel, You gotta wake up! Gabriel!
His eyes opened. He wasn't dead. Thank you, Emma thought, though it was unclear exactly who she was addressing. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Gabriel sat up, cradling his injured arm.
How did I get here?
You were fighting that monster. Only he must have been fighting dirty or tricked you, 'cause you fell on that. She pointed to the catwalk above them. She thought for a moment and added, But you bounced real hard and landed down here. If he didn't remember her pushing him off the catwalk, she saw no need to offer that information.
The mines! Yeah, one of them exploded. That monster was standing right beside it. We gotta get out of here. Come on.
Limping, they set off down the catwalk. The river was pouring in, filling up the hollow center of the dam. By the time they reached the stairs, water was already splashing about their ankles. Emma knew that once the dam filled with water, the pressure would be too much. The whole thing would simply snap and wash away. Then anyone still on the Countess's boat would die. But Dr. Pym had to have rescued Kate and the others by now. What good was him being a wizard if he couldn't do something as simple as get a bunch of kids off a boat? She let her annoyance at Dr. Pym distract her from the pain in her ankle. It helped as she climbed the stairs. They were halfway to the door when Gabriel suddenly stopped.
Gabriel, what are you doing? We...
Then she saw it. The creature was climbing up through the ribs of the dam, jumping from one beam to another. Her heart sank. What did it take to kill that stupid thing?
Your brother was right. It fears water.
It took Emma a moment to understand what he meant and recall how, back in Gabriel's cabin 2 days and what felt like a lifetime ago, Michael had suggested the Countess was keeping the monster on the boat because it was afraid of water. And now, as a new crack opened in the front wall and a fresh jet blasted through, Emma watched the creature howl and spring clear of the water's path. But still, it continued to climb.
"We gotta hurry!" Emma shouted. "It's gonna beat us to the door!"
Gabriel nodded and, with his good arm, hoisted Emma onto his shoulder. He took the stairs 3 at a time. The higher they went, the more the dam swayed and shuddered. Up they raced, amid the cracking and groaning, the thunderous pounding of the water, the sounds of timber snapping, and as fast as Gabriel climbed, the monster kept pace. Again and again it tried to move closer, but each time the dam splintered and a new jet of water forced it back. Emma silently urged Gabriel to go faster. Finally, they reached the top of the stairs, and Emma could see the door. Gabriel set her down. He was panting and his clothes were soaked with fresh blood.
"Come on," Emma cried. "We gotta hurry."
"I am not going."
"What are you talking about? This thing's gonna fall apart."
"The creature cannot be allowed to escape. When the dam breaks, it must be inside. That is the only way to kill it."
"So we'll lock the door. We won't let it out."
Gabriel shook his head.
"I must make sure."
Emma was growing frantic, trembling on the verge of tears. There was another massive crack. The landing they stood on dropped 2 feet.
"No, you, that's crazy. I won't let you."
Gabriel knelt so their faces were close together.
"I must do this, or every person this creature kills will be my responsibility. Life gives each of us tasks. This is mine."
"But you...
She was crying freely now, but didn't care. She had to make him see why what he was saying was so stupid, why he had to come with her. But for some reason, all she could manage was,
"You can't. You can't."
Gabriel placed his hand on her shoulder and looked into her eyes.
"I do not know what happened with your parents or why they did what they did, but in all the world, I could have wished for no daughter but you."
Sobbing, Emma threw herself around Gabriel's neck. She told him she loved him. She would never let him go. She didn't care what he said. She loved him.
"And I you. But you must go."
And he pulled her arms from around his neck and pushed her toward the stairs.
"Go, now!"
Shaking, hating herself with every step, Emma obeyed. Reaching the door, she looked back. Gabriel had turned to face the monster. He had no knife, no weapons, and as it sprang toward him, he leaped to meet it, grappling with the creature. Together, they plummeted into darkness. Moments later, Emma was stumbling along the edge of the gorge, tears streaming down her face, repeating over and over, "He's Gabriel. He'll be okay. He's Gabriel. He's Gabriel." When Michael and the children reached the shore, they were met by a group of men and dwarves who'd come through the passage Dr. Pym had created.
"Here, pull that boat up," called a familiar voice. "Look sharp now. Hey, blast you. I'll do it myself."
King Robbie grabbed the stern of the boat and, with half a dozen men and dwarves leaping to help, hauled it onto land. As the men began lifting out the children, Michael finally released the oars. He'd never been so exhausted. Pain arced across his back and shoulders, and he could scarcely raise his arms. He started out of the boat and promptly crashed face first into the gravel shore.
"Come now, boy. You're all done in."
It was Wallace. He set Michael on his feet, but continued to support him, clearly fearful he might topple over a second time. Robbie and Stephen McClattery's father hurried up.
"There are more kids."
"How many more, lad?"
Robbie demanded.
"Quick now."
30, at least. "And Dr. Pym and Kate. Dr. Pym took care of the screechers. I don't know about the Countess."
More men and dwarves had gathered round.
"We've got to go back for them."
"Get the boat in the water."
"Hold now," Robbie shouted. "We all heard that explosion. And you can hear the dam creaking and groaning from here. You won't get halfway before she bursts."
"What are we to do, then? Let our children die?"
"Course not, but we got to use our heads. How are we going to get there and not get dragged down the gorge when the dam goes? There's the question, blast it."
Most of the men and a few of the dwarves began shouting at once, some offering ideas, some cursing the Countess, some saying they didn't care if they were swept down the gorge, that those were their children on that boat. The arguing went on and on, with Robbie and Stephen McClattery's father calling again and again for order. Michael looked at the Countess's boat, sitting there so still upon the dark lake. The dam gave off another mournful groan, like some great beast in pain. And then it came to him. He saw how the whole thing would play out, and that he was the only one who could save the children. He took off running down the shore.
"Oi, lad," Wallace yelled, "where are you going?"
But Michael just kept running. Outside the Countess's cabin, there were children screaming. Inside, Dr. Pym would not wake up. No matter how many times Kate shook him and called his name, he just lay there. Finally, throwing one last glance at the unmoving body of the Countess, she placed the book on Dr. Pym's chest, grabbed him under the arms, and dragged him through the doorway, down a hall, and out onto the deck, apologizing each time she bumped his head. The deck was pandemonium. Terrified children were running and screaming in all directions. Twice Kate was knocked to the ground, and the child who'd collided with her got up, screamed, and ran off in the direction he had come. There were torches visible on both sides of the lake, and many of the children were standing on the railings, calling into the darkness for their mothers and fathers. Kate stared about in confusion. How had the children gotten free? Where were the Countess's screechers? Had Dr. Pym done this? Even as she asked the questions, she realized that none of them mattered. The only thing that mattered was how she was going to get all these children off the boat.
"Hey!"
Stephen McClattery was coming toward her.
"That the wizard?"
The question surprised her.
"How did you know?"
"Your brother told me."
"Michael? He's here?"
She felt her panic rising. She'd assumed he was safe. If he'd come to rescue her and was now in danger himself.
"No, he already took a boatload of kids to shore. Said he's coming back. Better hurry, though. You hear that explosion?"
"Yes."
Kate prayed guiltily that Michael would not return.
"Dam's been groaning and creaking ever since. Got all the kids scared."
He nodded to Dr. Pym.
"So, he dead or something?"
"No, he just won't wake up."
"What about the witch?"
"She's in there, dead, I think."
The boy's face broke into a broad grin.
Really? So we're going to be okay, huh?
Kate hesitated. Did she tell him the truth about the explosion? Tell him what all that groaning and creaking really meant? Could she trust him, or would it cause even greater panic? She never got the chance to decide. Emma had a plan. It boiled down to this. Find Dr. Pym and demand he fix everything. With that in mind, she'd run along the top of the gorge in a sort of staggering, hob-legged lunge. Her ankle was really hurting her, doing her best to ignore the wailing of the dam and push back thoughts of Gabriel, wounded and weak, fighting the Countess's monster. In her heart, she knew he was still alive, and if she could just get to Dr. Pym, everything would be fine. There was only one problem. As she neared the mouth of the gorge, she became aware of a cluster of scared-sounding voices rippling out from the center of the lake. With horror, Emma realized that the children were still on the boat. That meant Kate was still on the boat, maybe Michael too, and certainly Dr. Pym. Therefore, she had to be there. She knew the village would have boats, and so she started over the narrow bridge that spanned the gorge, head down, running full tilt, not looking where she was going. Suddenly, with a woof, she was on her back, her head ringing. She scrambled to get to her feet, imagining she'd crashed into a screecher. Then a voice spoke.
"Are you all right? Didn't see you coming."
A hand helped her up.
"I heard the explosion, so I hurried down to take some pictures. Afraid I was looking the other way."
It was Abraham. He had a camera hanging from his neck. He stared at her.
"You're one of them children I helped escape. What are you doing here?"
The words spilled out.
"Gabriel's in the dam fighting a monster. The whole thing's going to break apart any minute. I've got to get to Dr. Pym. The kids are still on the boat."
"Slow down, slow down. Who's Gabriel? Who's Dr. Pym? What monster?"
"No, listen. Those kids are still on the boat. We gotta..."
"Wait. The children are on the witch's boat?"
"Yeah, that's what I've been saying. Are you deaf or something?"
"We gotta get them off. If the dam goes..."
"Duh. That's what I was doing when you got in my way. That's why I gotta get to Dr. Pym."
"Well, I don't know this Dr. Pym, but we gotta organize rescue boats. We need to get those children to safety."
"Fine," Emma thought. "You do that, but I need a boat now." And she started to say that when there was a rending and scraping unlike any that had come before. Emma turned. Abraham gasped.
"Oh, dear Lord."
The dam was folding outward, split down the middle, and as the dark water rushed through, one entire half dislodged and was carried away. Emma threw herself against the railing, crying out her friend's name. To Abraham, who hadn't truly understood what she'd meant about Gabriel or Dr. Pym or the monster in the dam, but who knew suffering well enough, it sounded as if the young girl's heart was breaking. They were moving. Scarcely a minute had passed since Kate and Stephen McClattery had heard the unmistakable sound of the dam ripping free. And now, with each passing second, the boat was picking up speed. Kate thought the gorge was like a giant mouth, intent on swallowing the lake and everything in it, including them. She continued to shake Dr. Pym and call his name, but it was no use. And as she looked at Stephen McClattery running about, yelling at the children to grab hold of whatever they could find, she marveled that she'd come here to prevent this exact thing. How could she have failed so miserably? Even so, Kate was strangely calm. After all, she had been here before. In her vision, she had stood on the deck of the boat as it hurtled toward the falls. That had felt real. This, by contrast, seemed almost like a dream.
"Hold on!"
Stephen McClattery yelled. Kate looked up to see the jaws of the gorge rushing toward them. She was unprepared for the impact, and it sent her flying, slamming her hard into a wooden chest. The shock jarred her out of her reverie. She saw Dr. Pym's body sliding toward the edge of the deck, his arms still draped limply over the book. Kate dove at the wizard, pinning him down as the boat spun clockwise. She braced herself as the opposite wall came flying at them. They were in the gorge. There was no escaping now. She couldn't think about Gabriel. Kate and Michael. Kate and Michael. Think about them. They were still alive. But for how long? From where she and Abraham stood on the bridge, they'd seen the boat crash into the mouth of the gorge, get sucked into the narrow chute, and then be battered from one rocky wall to another, all the time going faster and faster. If that wasn't bad enough, the other half of the dam had finally broken free, which meant nothing now remained to stop the boat as it hurtled toward the falls. And all she could do was watch. Emma had never felt so helpless, so hopeless.
"Emma!"
Michael ran panting up the bridge. She threw her arms around him, sobbing.
"Michael, you're alive! I thought you were on the boat!"
Michael was so out of breath he couldn't speak, and it allowed Emma to say a few more times,
"You're alive! You're alive!" "Kate and Dr. Pym, they're on the boat with the kids." "I know. What are we going to do? Oh, Michael, Gabriel, he's..."
But she found she couldn't say the words to pronounce her friend dead. Not yet.
"That's Abraham."
Michael was staring at the man beside her.
"That's good." "I know that's Abraham. So what? Kate's on the boat. Why doesn't Dr. Pym do something? He should be..."
A sickening crunch made them turn. The boat had slammed into the wall of the gorge just 50 yards away, close enough that they could see the panicked children swarming the deck. Another moment and the boat would pass beneath the bridge.
"Make sure he takes the picture."
Michael was climbing onto the railing.
"What? What are you doing, Michael?" "Make sure you take the picture,"
Michael yelled at Abraham.
"Here now, lad."
"Michael, get down."
Standing on the railing of the bridge, Michael glanced once over the edge, then turned and looked at his sister. Something in his manner made Emma pause. She couldn't have said why it was, but it occurred to her suddenly that Michael was her older brother, and how she never thought of him that way.
"I love you,"
Michael said, and jumped.
"Michael!"
Emma flung herself against the railing in time to see her brother falling through darkness as the boat appeared below them, huge, spinning, doomed. She saw him land on the deck and roll, and then he was gone, the boat wheeling away toward the mouth of the falls, and there was nothing anywhere to stop it.
"Michael! Michael!"
She screamed so hard that her voice cracked, and she would have kept on screaming, but she heard other cries. Dark-clad women from the town, their shawls trailing, their hair loose, were emerging from the trees along the ridge. They ran with torches and lanterns and called to the children on the boat, and there was something so familiar and haunting about the scene that Emma kept staring. Then Abraham's camera flashed. He'd been holding it down by his chest and seemed surprised it had gone off. And Emma understood what Michael had said.
"Make sure he takes the picture."
He'd meant the picture Abraham had given her and Kate that day in his room. The one Abraham had said was the last photo he'd ever taken, the one with the names of the children written on the back. But why had Michael wanted him to take it? A wailing rose along the bridge, and Emma turned to see the boat spinning about and teetering backward on the lip of the falls. For one excruciating moment, it hung there, and Emma gripped the railing of the bridge and said her brother's name once more, almost a whisper.
"Michael!"
Then the bow rose, the stern went down, and the entire boat and all its passengers disappeared over the falls. Michael had landed on a pile of tarps. It took him a few seconds to get his bearings, for the boat was spinning faster and faster down the gorge, slamming first into one wall, then the other. All around him, children were clinging to railings, to ropes, to each other, screaming and crying. He glanced back and saw the silhouetted arc of the bridge. He prayed Abraham would take the picture, that Emma had understood. Then he put it out of his mind. He was running down the side of the boat in a drunken stagger, calling Kate's name, when someone grabbed his arm. It was Stephen McClattery. He was holding a young child and had an astonished look on his face.
"You came back again. How do you even...
Where's my sister?"
Stephen McClattery pointed to the front of the boat. Michael shouted,
"We need all the kids together."
"You crazy? They can't move."
"They have to. It's our only chance.
But just do it. Bring them to my sister. Go. We don't have much time.
For a brief instant, the boys stared at each other. Michael was younger than Stephen McClattery, scrawnier, but there was no question who was now in charge. Stephen McClattery nodded, turned to two boys standing nearby, and began yelling orders. Michael took off running. When he got to the forward deck, he found 24 wailing, terrified children and Kate up against a wall, her arms in a sort of hug around Dr. Pym and the book. Dr. Pym was unconscious.
"Michael, what are you..."
He knelt beside her.
"Kate, look. No, you shouldn't have come back."
She began crying and hitting him.
"Who's going to take care of Emma? You shouldn't have come back."
Then she wasn't hitting him anymore, just leaning against him, sobbing.
"You shouldn't have come back." "No, look, I brought this."
He dug into his jacket and pulled out his notebook. Opening it carefully, for the wind was whipping all about them, he showed her the photograph. Kate immediately recognized the dark figures running out of a wood, carrying torches and lanterns. It was the picture Abraham had given her and Emma.
"We can use it. We can put it in the book."
But Kate was already shaking her head.
"What about the others?"
"I got them."
It was Stephen McClattery, and he was dragging 6 children with him.
"Part of them, anyway. They got the rest."
He waved to the far side of the deck where the two older boys had just appeared, herding a group of children. By Michael's count, there were now more than 30 panicked children packed into the front of the boat.
"Make them hold hands," Michael shouted. "Hold hands!"
Stephen McClattery and his lieutenants took up the cry and ran about, pushing kids together, yelling in their ears. But whether the children didn't understand or were simply too terrified to obey, either way, it was hopeless.
"We need Dr. Pym."
Kate was shaking the old wizard fiercely. Michael thought for a moment, then told Kate to stop, and he dug into Dr. Pym's pockets till he found the tobacco. He shoved a wad of it under the wizard's nose, and almost immediately Dr. Pym snorted, and his eyes blinked open.
"Hmm," he said groggily. "What's that?" "Dr. Pym," Kate cried, "we're on the boat. We're about to go over the falls. We have a photo, but we need the children to hold hands."
Dr. Pym nodded, appeared to think, then said,
"What's that?"
Again, as if he'd not understood a single word. As Kate repeated what she'd said, Michael looked up and saw that they had run out of water. There was nothing but air before them.
"Kate!"
That was as far as he got. Just then, they struck a rock with such force that the entire boat spun around, so the front was now the back. And still they were rushing forward.
"It's too late," Stephen McClattery shouted. "We're going over."
The deck of the boat started to rise, and for the first time, Michael heard the roar of the falls.
"Kate," Michael said, "I'm sorry. I thought..." "It's okay," she said and squeezed his hand. "It's okay. We're together."
"Take the photo, Catherine. Be ready."
It was Dr. Pym. His voice was sharp. It snapped them back. Kate took the photo from Michael and opened the book. Dr. Pym was whispering something, and Michael suddenly found Stephen McClattery grasping his hand. He in turn grabbed his sister's arm, and then, as the boat dipped forward and the deck continued to rise, a strange calmness came over the children, and each one reached out and, in the darkness, found the hand of another child, forming one long chain snaking around the deck. And Dr. Pym was still whispering as the chain grew longer and longer till the last child was joined in, and the deck was so steep now that Michael had to brace himself to keep from sliding, and he looked down and saw past the boat to the nothingness below. And they were falling, all of them falling, and Dr. Pym shouted,
"Now!"
And the boat plunged forward.
"It'll be okay,"
Emma repeated for the 4th or 5th or 9th time.
"It'll be okay."
For a few seconds after the boat had gone over the falls, there had been a terrible drawn-out silence. Then they heard the crash, far below, and the women on the ridge fell to their knees and wailed. Amid the shrieking, Emma heard other voices, men's voices coming along the gorge behind her. But she didn't turn, just as she didn't run to the cliff to look over or stare at the spot on the falls where the boat had disappeared. She kept her eyes fixed on the woods behind the women and waited.
Please, she thought, her hands clenched around the railing of the bridge. Please.
And then there was a different cry, one that stopped the women on the cliff and made them turn. It was a young girl's voice. She was calling her mother. The girl was no more than 7 or 8, and as she came running out of the trees, one of the women cried out and ran to meet her, folding the girl in her arms. And then there were more cries, the children streaming out of the woods in 2s and 3s, and tearful reunions began happening all along the ridge. And Emma felt the tight knot of fear that was binding her dissolve, and she was running down the bridge toward the trees, the pain in her ankle forgotten, knowing they would be there, knowing they would never desert her, running into the waiting arms of her brother and sister. Chapter 24. Rakotis.
Remember, Dr. Pym said, by going into the past, you children changed history. We must therefore imagine what would have transpired had you not travelled through time.
Kate, Michael and Dr. Pym were sitting on the side of a fallen tree. 10 minutes had passed since the boat had gone over the falls, and they had appeared in the woods. And still, all around them, families reunited for the first time in 2 years. Mothers and fathers, who minutes before had thought their children lost for good, were clasping each other in disbelief. Dr. Pym was in the process of answering one of Michael's questions. Michael had wanted to know how the Atlas could have gotten from the vault in the dead city to the study underneath the house. It was the sort of academic, essentially pointless question that he found fascinating. Kate was only half listening. She was watching Emma, who had wandered off to the edge of the gorge. For now, Kate thought it best to give her sister space.
So, the wizard continued, in what I will call the original past, prior to all your time jumping, the Countess would have searched for, but not discovered, the Atlas under the dead city. Led by Gabriel, the men of Cambridge Falls would have shaken off their captors and rebelled. The Countess, knowing her master would not accept failure, would have destroyed herself and the children, and, in the process, cursed the town. Now, in any version of events, I would have found myself in Hamish's dungeon. Let us assume I eventually freed myself, though not in time to thwart the Countess. Fearful that the witch's master would send another emissary to pick up where the Countess left off, I would have removed the Atlas from the vault. From there, I can easily imagine how I might have taken over the Countess's house and constructed an underground room to serve as a new repository. It would have appealed to my sense of irony as if I were placing the book under her very nose. Then I would simply have woven a new enchantment so that if one of the three of you showed up, the door would reveal itself. Is that more or less what happened?
Michael said it was.
Well, there's your answer.
They all fell silent. Michael seemed to have run out of questions. It was Kate who finally spoke.
It's time, isn't it?
Yes, Dr. Pym replied. You have done what you came to do. It is time.
Kate rose and crossed to her sister. The wind was whipping up over the lip of the gorge, carrying spray from the falls.
Are you cold?
Kate asked.
No. Emma, we did a really good thing.
Emma said nothing.
I'm so sorry about Gabriel. He's down there, somewhere.
Kate didn't reply, but she put her arm around her sister, and together they gazed at the dark water rushing over the falls.
Dr. Pym wants us to go, doesn't he?
Yes.
Okay.
They walked over to Michael and Dr. Pym. From her jacket pocket, Emma pulled the photo she'd taken of Kate in their bedroom, the one she'd snapped just before they'd gone back in time to rescue Michael. She gave it to her sister. Around them, families were beginning to drift toward the town.
"Will you be there?" Kate asked, "when we get back?"
"Believe me, it is my firmest intention."
"Dr. Pym,"
Emma began.
"My dear, Robbie and his dwarves are already looking for Gabriel. He will be well taken care of."
"Dwarves are excellent trackers," Michael said. "Gigi Greenleaf..."
"Michael," Kate said.
"Yes?"
"Be quiet."
"Okay."
Emma and Michael joined hands, and Michael took hold of Kate's arm. Kate opened the book. She stopped.
"Dr. Pym?"
Kate picked up something from between two pages. It was Abraham's photo showing the women running along the top of the gorge, the one Michael had given her as the boat was hurtling toward the falls. Kate didn't understand. She'd used this picture to move them through time. It should have disappeared.
"Ah," Dr. Pym said quietly. "So, it's happened."
"What do you mean?"
Kate demanded.
"What's happened? Why is it still here?"
"Catherine, do you recall what I told you in Hamish's throne room?"
"No, but..."
"Try and remember. It will make things clear. Either way, I will explain in the future. For now, put the other photograph in the book. See if it disappears. My guess is that it will not."
"Please,"
he said when he saw her hesitate.
"Trust me."
"I do,"
Kate said, and she meant it. Kate handed Abraham's photo to Michael, who slid it in his notebook, and then she made one last check to ensure that she and her brother and sister were touching. She noticed something sliding along the shadows of the trees. She looked closer, but whatever it was had faded into the darkness. "Just get on with it," Kate thought, and with that, she placed the photo of herself on the blank page. There was a familiar tug. The scene before them disappeared, and then they were in their bedroom in the mansion, and once again there was the feeling of being held in place as they watched the other Kate and the other Emma prepare to travel into the past to rescue their brother. Then Kate watched her other self place the photo in the atlas, vanish, and they were released.
"Boy,"
Emma muttered,
"are they in for it?"
"Did the photo disappear?"
Michael asked.
"No,"
Kate said, showing it to them.
"It's still here."
Just then they heard the door open behind them.
"So, your majesties are here, after all."
The children turned. The old housekeeper was standing in the doorway.
"Miss Sallow," Kate said,
"we didn't hear me knocking the last 10 minutes. Thought you'd played a joke on old Sallow. What a laugh you must have had. I wasn't aware I was employed at the Comédie Française."
"Miss Sallow?"
"Dr. Pym is below and wishing the pleasure of your company. Will you be making an appearance, or should I say their royal highnesses wish to stay in their chamber making bon mots and fa-la-la-ing at an old woman's expense?"
Kate whispered to Michael and Emma.
"Go on, I'll catch up. I want to hide the book."
As soon as her brother and sister disappeared with the old lady, Kate turned and stuffed the book under the mattress. Her hands were shaking. She knew that the photos not disappearing was important. But how? What was it Dr. Pym had told her in Hamish's throne room? If only she could focus, if she could just clear her head for a moment. But there was so much else to think about. The prophecy and all that entailed, the other two books of beginning, the Dire Magnus, he was still out there. Her mother. Her mother had known who she was. Her mother had recognized her. Kate was still thinking of that, or not thinking of it so much as reveling in the warmth of the memory, when she drew back the blanket and stood. That's when it came to her. Dr. Pym had told her that she was the only one who could access the book's full power. "He means I can move through time," Kate thought, "that I don't need a photograph." But he'd said something else as well. What was it? She had to find the wizard.
"Katrina!"
Kate spun around. An ancient woman, a crone, bent-backed and wrapped in a ragged, filthy shawl, shuffled forth from a panel that had opened beside the fireplace. Her arms were little more than bones, The skin that clung to them was slack and spotted with sores. Lank strands of hair hung from her skull. Her blackened, swollen feet poked through the cracks in her shoes. She smiled, showing a mouthful of brown teeth. Kate's eyes shot to the door. Emma, Michael, and Miss Sallow were long gone.
15 years, the Countess croaked. 15 years I've waited. For you, it's been a matter of moments. You stepped across time as you would over a crack in the floor. But I've waited, mon ange, every day, every hour, for 15 years, waiting for when we would meet again.
She moved between Kate and the door, blocking her escape. Not that it mattered. Kate couldn't move. Fear held her in place. The Countess was alive. But how was that possible? Kate didn't have to ask what the woman wanted. She had come for the Atlas.
You can't believe your old friend the Countess is still creaking along, can you? You thought my old master killed me, yes. No, no. He merely took back his power, left me empty and weak. A wretched sack of skin and bones. You didn't know that I woke up on the floor of that cursed boat, that I dragged my broken body onto the deck and saw you and that wizard and the rest of the brats. I knew what you were doing. Oh, yes. And I joined your little chain at the last moment. When you saved the children, my sweet cat, you also saved my life.
She began laughing. It turned into a coughing fit, and she hacked something into her fist, which she wiped on the edge of her shawl.
Afterward, I stayed hidden in the trees and watched the children reunite with their pathetic mothers and fathers. I couldn't risk facing your wizard. But I saw you and your brother and sister with the book, and I knew then that I would wait. Everyone would believe I was dead. Even my master would think I had perished when the boat went over the falls. I saw how the Atlas could still be mine.
She seized Kate's arm. Her nails were black and splintered.
Year after year I waited. The townspeople didn't recognize me. The same children I had once imprisoned brought me food and water. I was patient. Then, one day, I heard of the 3 children who had come to the house across the river. I had long ago discovered the hidden passages in the walls. Unnoticed, I slept in. I crept along. I watched. And there I saw you, my beautiful Katrina. Not a day, not a moment older.
She was close now, her sour breath washing over Kate's face.
Give me the Atlas.
Kate hesitated. Should she scream? Would anyone hear her?
I know what you're thinking, my dove. But your Dr. Pym won't hear you. He's too far away. You know who will hear you? Little Michael and Emma. They'll come running, and I will make you watch as I kill them both. I've waited too long. Give me the Atlas.
From the folds of her shawl, the crone drew a long, rusty-toothed knife. Kate let her eyes go to the knife's edge, then back to the hag's eyes. Promise you won't hurt Michael or Emma.
Please,
she smiled horribly.
I'm not a monster.
And you'll leave right after.
Like I was never here.
Okay, then. Kate turned and reached under the mattress. She had no intention of handing over the book. She merely wanted the witch to think she'd won so that her guard would relax. Gripping the book's cover, Kate stood up suddenly, spinning around, swinging the leather-bound tome with all her might at the Countess's head. The old woman's hand shot up and caught the book. They stood like that, Kate holding one end, the Countess the other, her nails digging into the emerald cover. The witch began cackling.
"Cheeky little girl, not so trusting any more, are we? Fortunately, the Countess is stronger than she looks. Now, let go!"
The Countess gave a terrific yank, and Kate's hands slipped. But it was too much. The crone lost her balance, and the book fell, landing open upon the floor. Kate and the witch both dove for it. Then the Countess was clawing at the book, hissing, jabbing her knife at Kate's face. And Kate was leaning back, her fingers locked over an open page, refusing to let go, refusing to let this woman win. And as the blade came toward her, Kate did the only thing she could think of. Closing her eyes, she reached for the magic in the book with every fiber of her being and prayed that Dr. Pym was right. She felt the tug immediately. Strange as it seemed, Kate had the sense that the Atlas and the power inside it had been waiting for her all this time. But the thrill only lasted a second. Then it was as if she was cast in the middle of a great ocean, far from the sight of land. The Countess was still with her, but only as a presence. Kate started to feel herself sinking, and she realized that she could just disappear, vanish into time itself. Maybe that was okay, maybe that's what was meant to happen. But then, as she had in the bedroom, she found herself remembering being held by her mother, remembering how her mother had recognized her, and a flame of pure love sparked in her breast. In that moment, the rest of what Dr. Pym had said came back to her. Before she could access the book's power, her heart needed to heal. "Okay," she thought. "Imagine you have a photograph. Tell the book where to go." The next moment she was blinking in the sunlight, standing on the roof of a building in a brown, sun-baked city. Red dust hung in the air while shouts rose from the street below. The Countess had fallen to her knees, gasping for breath. Her knife lay on the ground, and Kate kicked it away.
"How did you? How did you do that?"
"I don't need a photograph anymore. The Atlas just does what I want."
"No, it's not possible."
"Really? Look around. Seems pretty possible to me."
"But you can't."
"Actually, I think I always could. I just wasn't ready. Dr. Pym knew that. He told me the book wouldn't listen to me till my heart was healed." Kate was speaking more to herself than to the Countess. She needed to say aloud what she now knew. "Imagine having one question at the center of your life, and until you answer that question, you'll always be lost. For me, it was wondering if our parents had really loved us. How could they when they'd abandoned us? But when you helped me go back in time, my mother knew who I was. She recognized me as her daughter. I'll never question her love again. It's like knowing where North is. Whatever happens, I'll have that to guide me." The Countess had struggled to her feet. Her once violet eyes were black with hatred. Kate wasn't scared anymore. In fact, she felt a remarkable sense of calm.
"It's funny. If you hadn't sent me back in time, I never would have figured that out. Though then again, I'm pretty sure Dr. Pym planned it all from the moment he gave me the memory of my mother. I'll have to ask him when I see him."
"Child, I am going to rip—"
Her threat was cut short by an explosion in a nearby street. The Countess whirled about.
"Where are we? Where have you brought us?"
Kate shrugged. "I forget the name of the city. It's the one you told me about, where the Council of Magicians first wrote the books. You said it was destroyed by Alexander the Great. I told the Atlas to take us there."
"You brought us to Rakotis?"
"I guess."
"You foolish girl! Look!"
The Countess pointed one long crooked finger, and Kate turned. Behind her stretched an endless blue sea, shining in the sun. and upon it were thousands and thousands of ships. Kate could hear drums sounding across the water, and as she watched, balls of flame shot up from the decks of the closest ships. The missiles crashed about the city. In the space of a few seconds, a dozen fires were raging all about them. Kate could hear people screaming as they ran for safety.
"We must go. Help me, and I will help you. You have power. I see that now. The Atlas has claimed you, but you have no idea what lies ahead. Help me, and I will help you."
"Why would I need your help?"
"Because I know my master. He is always searching. For you and your brother and sister, for the books, the Dire Magnus will find you."
At the mention of his name, Kate imagined she heard the violin. She knew it was only in her head, but even so, the memory of the music chilled her. The Countess lunged closer.
"You have seen him. You know he will break your magician like a twig, and then you will all become his slaves. I can help you. Help you get the other two books. Don't you see? That is your only hope. He will never stop searching. You must get the books first."
"We'll hide," the old woman hissed and waved her gnarled hand dismissively.
"Hide? For how long? Your entire lives? He'll find you. He'll find you, and through you, he'll find the books. And then he will ravage this world. I have told you what the books can do, and..."
She paused, leering.
"I would have thought you cared more for your parents."
Kate's heart lurched in her chest. She suddenly found it hard to breathe.
What do you mean?"
The Countess smiled, sensing she had gained the upper hand.
"So, the wizard hasn't told you yet. Too bad, too bad. But I still have my old ear to the ground, don't I? Especially when it comes to Mon Petit Oiseau. 10 years ago, the Dire Magnus finally tracked you and little Michael and Emma down."
"But how?"
"The prophecy, of course. There were signs, but the wizard was too fast. Spirited you away. Your sweet parents, not so lucky. No, no, not so lucky at all."
She came closer.
10 years now. 10 years your loving parents have been the prisoners of the Dire Magnus."
"You're lying."
"Oh, be nice to think so, wouldn't it? But you know I'm not. The Dire Magnus has your parents, and the only way you'll get them back is to find the other two books first. For that, you need the Countess's help."
Her parents were prisoners. That was why they'd never come for them. Terrible as it was, Kate felt a strange sense of relief. Her own history finally made sense. There was a ripping in the air, and Kate and the Countess both looked and saw another fiery salvo, even larger than the last, erupting from the ships. The city was doomed. The Countess seized Kate's arm.
"Now, take me back. I am your only hope."
But Kate shook her head and said simply, "No, you stay." She wrenched her arm free at the same time as she reached for the magic. The last thing she saw was the Countess flying at her as the sky around them filled with fire. A second later, Kate was standing in the bedroom, alone, holding the emerald green book.
"Hey, what are you doing? I thought you were hiding that."
Emma was at the door.
"Are you okay?"
Kate realized she was holding her breath. She exhaled.
"I'm fine. I just..."
"Emma, what's wrong? What's happened?" Her sister had tears in her eyes.
"You gotta come, Kate. You gotta see."
Chapter 25. Ghosts of Christmas Past. As Kate hurried with Emma through the dark hallways of the house, she couldn't help noticing that everything was in a state of extreme disrepair. Mirrors were crusted with grime, cobwebs clung to the corners, mouse-eaten rugs covered creaking, dusty floors. In short, the house looked exactly as it had before they'd gone into the past. Emma wouldn't tell her what had happened, which was fine, actually, as Kate was still thinking about all the Countess had said. How the dire Magnus was holding their parents prisoner. How their only hope of rescuing them was to get the other two books. She knew she had to tell Michael and Emma, but first she wanted to talk to Dr. Pym. They stopped at the door to the ballroom. Emma faced her.
"Are you ready?"
Without waiting for an answer, Emma turned the handles. As the doors swung open, Kate was assaulted by a blast of light and music. The ballroom was filled with people eating, drinking, talking, and for a moment, Kate thought they had stumbled into the Countess's ghostly St. Petersburg gala. Only this wasn't the Countess's gala. The music was festive. There was a huge tree in the center of the room. The walls were hung with garlands and holly. The guests, while dressed in their seasonal best, were very clearly not the cream of St. Petersburg society. And then there were the children. They ran about, weaving between the adults, chasing one another and yelping with high spirits.
"What is this?" Kate said.
Emma didn't reply, and Kate saw that she was being noticed. One partygoer would look over, whisper to another, who would whisper to another, who would whisper to another. In just a few seconds, the entire ballroom had fallen silent and turned to stare.
"Emma? What's going—"
She was drowned out as every person there began to cheer and clap.
"Okay," Kate said. "This is creepy." "There you are! Welcome, welcome!"
Dr. Pym, wearing the same tweed suit she'd seen him in 15 years and not 5 minutes before, emerged from the applauding crowd. He was beaming.
"A merry Christmas, my dear! A merry, 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 merry Christmas!"
He bowed, folding himself nearly in half.
"Dr. Pym," Kate said, "who are? What's going on?"
"Why, it's a party."
Then he lowered his voice so that only Kate could hear.
"Have no fear. The dire Magnus cannot harm you tonight. I have seen to it."
Kate nodded dumbly. She was staring at the crush of partygoers closing in on them.
"Uh-huh.
But—" Michael stepped up behind the wizard.
"It's okay, Kate. Everything's all right."
And indeed, all the people seemed to want to do was shake Kate's hand, say thank you, and wish her a Merry Christmas. They were men and women of all ages, and Kate saw that many had tears in their eyes, and they held on to her hand as if they'd been waiting for this moment for many years and were unwilling to let it pass too quickly.
"Dr. Pym," she said as she emerged from the embrace of a round woman who'd blubbered all over her shoulder. "Who are these people?"
"These are the fine people of Cambridge Falls. We host an annual Christmas party here at the house. I find it a good way to dispel bad spirits, though I still can't persuade Miss Sallow to clean the place properly. She really is a dismal housekeeper."
"Don't you see?" Emma cried. "They're the kids. The ones we saved. All grown up."
Just then a young couple with a baby walked up. Both the man and the child had curly red hair.
"It's really you," the man said. "We hardly believed it when Dr. Pym said you'd be here tonight. You don't look at all different. Smaller, I guess, but that's to be expected."
Kate had the feeling she knew this man, but she couldn't say from where or how. The woman smiled.
"They don't recognize you, dear."
"Right, of course. I'm Stephen McClattery. I grew up a little, and this is Annie, my wife. Do you remember her?"
"Oh," Kate said. "Oh, I had glasses," Annie said. "I remember."
Kate was thinking of how she had once held this girl, now a woman, in her arms.
"We'd like you to meet our daughter," Annie said. "We named her Catherine. We owe everything to you. We all do. Everyone here."
Kate looked at the baby and felt her eyes welling with tears. Choking, she was able to murmur,
"She's beautiful."
"You know," cried a hearty voice, "let me through. I want a crack at 'em."
The dwarf king, Robbie McClower, was pushing his way good-naturedly through the crowd. He wore a red and green checked vest, and his beard was neatly plaited into four braids, each tied with an emerald ribbon. With his vest, his braided, beribboned beard, and his general air of smartness, Kate thought he looked like nothing so much as the most prancing of all prancing ponies. That is to say, she thought he looked marvelous. Michael exclaimed, "Your Highness, no one told me you were here," and immediately dropped to a knee. Emma groaned, "You are so embarrassing."
"Here now, none of that from you."
Robbie dragged Michael to his feet and clasped him in a ferocious hug.
"A sight for sore eyes, lad. All three of you. A sight for sore eyes."
Then Kate saw the other dwarf standing a few paces back. He wore a red and gold vest and was grinning broadly through his black beard.
"Wallace!"
she cried and ran forward. Laughing, he wrapped her in his short, muscular arms, then stepped back to better take her in.
"Last time I saw you was in the Dead City near 15 years ago. In fact, you might have been wearing them exact clothes."
"Wallace, I'm so sorry about what I did."
No apologies. Things turned out right in the end." "Aye, that they did,"
Robbie cut in.
"Not least, we've re-established ties with the Cambridge Fallsians. Not a bad egg among them. Oh, before I forget, Hamish sends his apologies. He couldn't make it."
"Really?"
Kate said.
"Really?"
Michael said. Robbie roared with laughter and slapped Michael's back so hard that Michael nearly toppled over.
"Course not! I've got that degenerate back at the palace handing out presents. I make him dress up like Santa every year, bounce some young dwarf fist on his knee. Lord, but he hates it."
Kate saw that her sister was standing on her toes, straining to peer out over the crowd. Kate's heart sank, realizing what or who Emma was searching for. Kate knew that now was the time to go to her, but just then she was waylaid by another pair of grown-up children who wanted to meet her, thank her, have her kiss their child. When she turned back around, Emma was gone. She found her sister outside on the back patio, the same one where 15 years earlier the three of them had sat with the Countess while the witch had explained the history of the Books of Beginning. That night had been warm, filled with the end of summer. It was winter now. A hard crust of snow covered the stone-flagged patio, and Kate could see her breath. She closed the doors behind her, shutting out the noise of the party, and crossed to her sister. Emma was staring at the dark line of trees, her arms wrapped tightly around herself. Kate wondered if she even felt the cold.
"I thought he'd be here," Emma said. "Everyone else is here. Those dwarves and... I just thought he'd be here too. Stupid, I guess."
Kate put her hand on her sister's back.
"I'm sorry."
They stood like that for perhaps half a minute, neither moving nor speaking. Kate wondered if she should make Emma come inside. It was too cold to be out without a coat, and she wanted to tell her and Michael what she'd learned about their parents. She was about to speak when Emma let out a gasp and bolted down the stone steps and out into the snow.
"Emma, wait! What are you—"
Then she saw the dark shape that had separated itself from the trees and was moving toward them.
"No," Kate thought. "It can't be."
Emma was running through the knee-high drifts, shouting the name, and when she reached the figure, she threw herself into its outstretched arms. Kate heard Emma's muffled voice.
"I knew it! I knew it!"
Moments later, the man, still holding Emma, stepped up onto the patio. He was wearing a long, bearskin coat, and snow had gathered on his shoulders and hair. The face was more lined than Kate remembered, and there were grey streaks at his temples. Emma's face was buried in his collar.
"Hello,"
Gabriel said. Kate nodded, still dumbstruck.
"You're cold. We should go inside."
And he stepped forward and opened the door.
"Ah,"
Dr. Pym said as Gabriel approached with the two girls, Emma walking beside him now, clutching his hand.
"You made it.
I heard there was quite a bit of snow your side of the mountain.
Michael stared. His expression, Kate suspected, much as hers had been a few moments earlier.
I thought he was... Wait! How...
The wizard was smiling, enjoying the confusion and saying nothing.
It's good to see you,
Gabriel said in his deep, serious voice.
I'm sorry, Kate said, but Michael's right. How...
Am I not dead?
Well, yes, because Gabriel's too tough for some stupid monster,
Emma blurted.
Ain't that right?
She wiped at her face, and Kate saw that she was crying with happiness.
I have you to thank, Gabriel said to Michael.
Me? Him?
Emma said.
He didn't do anything. I'm the one who took apart those mind thingies. I'm the one who pushed you off the catwalk.
Gabriel looked at her.
I mean,
Emma said quickly,
found you on the catwalk after you fell there when you bounced off the first one.
Had it not been for your brother,
Gabriel continued, it might not have occurred to me that the monster feared water.
But that was how I finally defeated it. As the water rose, I was able to drown the hellish creature.
And you still escaped?
Kate marveled.
The last thing I remember is running up the stairs as the dam fell to pieces around me. King Robbie and his dwarves found me unconscious at the edge of the gorge.
That we did!
The dwarf king tucked his thumbs in his vest pockets and swayed back and forth.
Had a devil of a time trying to move him. Lad weighs more than a draft horse.
Wow! I guess dwarves are good for stuff after all,
Emma said generously. Then she pulled Gabriel down, and Kate saw her whisper something in his ear, and she heard Gabriel reply,
I know, me too.
Kate looked at Dr. Pym.
So, it's all right then? Everyone's okay?
Much more than okay. Look about you. This is all thanks to you.
And Kate looked at the families arrayed before them and thought,
we did this. Whatever else happens, we did this.
Now, Dr. Pym said, if you will excuse me, I've been eyeing that cider.
No, I have to tell you something.
Yes, my dear.
The old wizard was waiting. So, in fact, were Michael and Emma. Emma holding Gabriel's hand, Michael standing with King Robbie and Wallace. Both looked happier than Kate had ever seen them.
Yes, Catherine?
Kate knew that the moment she told them what the Countess had said, that it was up to them to rescue their parents from the dire Magnus, the night was over. She thought of what a long journey they'd had to get here, how far they still had to go. Michael and Emma would need tonight.
I just wanted to say, Merry Christmas, everyone!
And so the evening went on, and there was singing and dancing, caroling around the fire. Stephen McClattery apologized for having tried to have Michael hanged, and they told him not to worry about it. The children saw Abraham hobbling about with a camera, and they hugged him and thanked him for everything. Wallace and King Robbie taught the children dwarf Christmas carols that seemed to have only passing mentions of Christmas, and be much more about the benefits and drawbacks of various mining techniques. Michael took notes. There was a long table with the best kinds of food imaginable. Roast pig with maple glaze, lamb and mint jelly, crispy golden potatoes, garlic and cheese mashed potatoes, steaming bowls of chowder. The desserts alone took up two tables, one of which was devoted entirely to different varieties of doughnuts. Chocolate doughnuts, cinnamon doughnuts, chocolate and cinnamon doughnuts, powdered doughnuts with raspberry filling, with blackberry filling, with strawberry or blueberry filling. Michael pressed Emma to try what he promised was a delicious mushroom doughnut, but she told him not to be disgusting. There were apple and pear and honey ciders, steaming vats of mulled wine, great frothy mugs of hot chocolate, a keg of dwarf ale that King Robbie had brought, and that seemed to be extremely popular. And adults who'd already come up and thanked the children came up a second and a third time, dragging along Abraham to take their picture. And they met children named Kate, and children named Michael, and children named Emma.
so many that Kate wondered how, when a mother called her son or daughter home in the evening, she didn't get half the town's children stomping through her door. And the children ate too much and drank too much, and the only person who was grumpy in the least was Miss Sallow, and that was simply the way she was. Kate tried her best to join in, but the thoughts of all that had happened and all the Countess had said wouldn't go away. Who was the Dia Magnus? What did it mean that she could use the Atlas without a photograph? Was there more to the prophecy than what the Countess had mentioned? And what about the other two books? What powers and secrets did they contain? There was so much she didn't understand. And then there were the questions about their parents. Thinking of what they must have gone through, what they must still be going through, made Kate dizzy with fear and sadness. But even so, there was one thing she did know for certain. If their parents were alive, then she and Michael and Emma were going to find them. She didn't care how powerful the Dia Magnus was, or that to rescue their parents they would have to find a pair of magical books that had been missing for thousands of years. She and Michael and Emma were going to put their family back together, and nothing was going to stop them. "Kate!" Emma ran up, Michael just behind her, their faces bright with joy. "King Robbie's gonna whistle, deck the halls through his nose. Dwarves, right? This should be hilarious." "Nose whistling is an ancient dwarf tradition," Michael protested, then added, "but it should be pretty funny." "Come on, Kate, you gotta come. You really shouldn't miss it."
"Robbie's gonna whistle Christmas carols through his nose?" Kate laughed.
"What are we waiting for?" And, smiling, she let herself be led away by her brother and sister.
This is Jim Dale. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Emerald Atlas by John Stevens. This program was directed by John McElroy. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. This program was recorded and edited at John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 2011 by John Stevens. Production copyright 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.